Sometimes God asks us to do something that we think is absolutely crazy. And the book of Hosea is one such example. I call it the prophet of a failed marriage, because God asked Hosea to do something that, well, he didn't really ask anybody else to do in the Bible. And that is to be so loyal to his wife, despite her infidelity, that he would actually be a wonderful picture of God doing the same thing. Our key word for the book of Hosea is loyal. It's a Hebrew term that has covenant connotations. It means you're being faithful to your covenant, that you've made a covenant, that you've made a promise. And in this context, this is the promise of marriage. And Hosea actually doing this very difficult thing of being married to Gomer and being faithful to her despite her unfaithfulness is a tremendous illustration of God doing the same with Israel, and frankly, God doing the same with us. The theme is God's loyalty to Israel, but by extension, you can see the Lord has done the same with us, and he does the same today. I don't think any one of us here would say we've been completely faithful to the Lord, but I don't think any of us, if we're thinking straight, would say that God has not been completely faithful to us. In fact, the Lord says in chapter 2, verse 23, in our key verse, he says about Israel, I'll plant her for myself in the land. I'll show my love. Or you could translate that loyalty. It's the Hebrew word chesed. Chesed. It's a hard word to say. Well, maybe not so hard. It's only two syllables, but it has the concept of loving loyalty, loving faithfulness. The King James Version translates it loving kindness. But when we hear words like loving kindness, honestly, I think a lot of even us Christians kind of turn that off. We kind of go, oh, that old English, I don't understand that sort of stuff, you know. But think about the word loving kindness. It means that you're demonstrating kindness in your love, in your commitment. It's actually a concept that we need to see more today. Sadly, it is a concept that was popular during the time of the King James Version 4 centuries ago, and we need to see more of it today. But anyway, God says, I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love or my loyalty to the one called not my loved one. I'll say to those called not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. When I think of this, I think of how few Jews today even really claim to be the people of God. They are more caught up in their traditions. I saw the interview of a rabbi recently about Passover. And the interviewer said, well, what do you think about Passover? And he said, well, I don't really think there was an actual historical event where Israel actually came out of Israel. I mean, Israel actually came out of Egypt. And the interviewer said, you don't believe it actually took place then? And the rabbi said, I don't think it's really significant whether it took place or not. The main thing is that you believe it. He said, well, do you believe it? And he said, I believe in the tradition, and I believe that there's good, it's good for people to gather together and have these traditions. And so believing becomes a reality for us. I'm paraphrasing him, but I thought, you don't believe that history has any bearing on your life. He didn't see himself as part of the people of God that God had redeemed from Egypt. He just saw this is a good tradition that kind of binds people together. So yeah, I celebrate Passover. Celebrate. What do you actually celebrate? Well, unless you be critical of him, think about how many Christians celebrate Christmas. Do they really, truly believe Jesus was born of a virgin? I tell you, there's hundreds of millions of people who celebrate Christmas who do not believe in the virgin birth. They don't believe God became man. But they say a similar thing. They say, well, it's a good time, giving gifts, having good food together, a good family time. All the social dimensions of Christmas are really, they're really good things, aren't they? And you can't say, well, no, it's not good for families to get together. No, no, I don't like Christmas pudding. No, I don't. You could be the real, you know, Grinch. But God's saying, no, in a very real sense, my people are going to be going away from us, just as Gomer goes away from Hosea. But I'm bringing them back. I love my wife Israel enough to go get her and restore her to me. To those who's called not my people, he's going to say, you are my people. And they're going to respond. They're going to say, you are my God. What we have here is a prophecy that in the days to come, that Israel as a whole are going to acknowledge God as their Lord. They're going to see his loving loyalty to the nation has been steadfast throughout the generations. So that Israel's never been eradicated. They've been certainly persecuted, but they've never been eradicated. They've never even been absorbed into other nations. They have, by God's grace, remained separate to the degree that they could actually come back to their own land after 19 centuries of being away from their homeland. There's no parallel in all of human history to that. There's no other people that have been away from their land, their homeland, for centuries and then actually been restored to their land. Every other people that's been away like that gets absorbed. I mean, it's the case for you and me, isn't it? How many of us are actually tied on into our ancestors? How many of us know the names of our great-grandpa? Any of you know the name of your great-grandfather? Not even one in this class. One of us. Two of us. Okay. Two of us know the name of our great-grandfather. That's how, out of 33 of us, that's how we are not tied into our past. I can't give you the name of my great-grandfather. But God knows all these things. And despite God's discipline of Israel for rejecting him, God remains loyal to the nation as a motivation for the nation to submit to him, to his rule as a loving husband. So here we have the marriage imagery very strong in the book of Hosea, perhaps stronger than any other book, certainly stronger than any other prophet, because the whole concept of spiritual infidelity just permeates this book. This is the opposite, you might say, of Song of Songs, that just oozes with fidelity and commitment and love. Well, God does it in Hosea. Hosea does it in Hosea. It's just Gomer, as a picture of the nation, does not do so. And in terms of the summary statement, Hosea experiences a personal marriage tragedy, which illustrates God's faithful reception of his unfaithful people, who show three main characteristics. Lack of knowledge of God. They don't really know the Lord. Rejection of loyal love, and then faithlessness to his covenant. And why does he write this? To motivate them to repent. So covenant, wow, this is a huge issue in the book of Hosea. The whole book is about covenant love, chesed, loyal love. And loyal love is a covenant love, or a covenant promise, where God remains true to his promises of restoration despite Israel's lack of covenant love. Over and over in the book, he says, I'm showing you covenant love, Israel. You are not showing me covenant love. But my love for you is not conditional. I'm going to keep loving you anyway. And God says such because his own character, his own attributes are built up into who he is. Frankly, I guess you could say they all are for us, right? You are the sum of your attributes, your character. except we can be inconsistent. We can act against what we know. God doesn't do that. God has to be consistent with his attributes. And in this particular one, it's his covenant loyalty that is in play here in the book of Hosea. In terms of redemption, the redemption of Gomer from the slave market actually pictures God's redeeming love of the spiritually adulterous nation of Israel. What happens is Hosea marries her, and she goes off into infidelity, and he actually finds her up on the block for slaves to be sold, and he buys her. I can hardly imagine such a thing. Many of us are married. I can hardly imagine that sort of thing happening in my marriage. Can you imagine such a thing happening in your marriage? Where your spouse is actually sold into slavery because of infidelity, not taken by some conquering nation who takes, you know, for you men, who takes your wife away, then you go and rescue her, but she voluntarily goes off. Nobody forced her to be caught up in prostitution, but she just ended up doing it. And then you go and buy her back. Wow. Talk about a great illustration of redemption. And in terms of Messiah, Christ's redeeming work appears in calling Israel out of Egypt. We see Hosea 11:1 that is depicted for us in Matthew 2. It says, Jesus returning from Egypt with his parents. He's drawing a parallel. There are different ways to look at this. I don't know if he's specifically saying this is a prophecy of Jesus, or Matthew is actually saying, just as Israel was brought up out of Egypt, so Jesus will be brought up out of Egypt. He's drawing that kind of a parallel. But anyway, it's a messianic reference here. So what we've got here in the book is quite simple in terms of its outline. God's loyalty to Israel, his loyal love to Israel. The first three chapters talking about unfaithful Gomer with faithful Hosea. So that his marriage and his personal marriage tragedy, frankly, illustrates what we find in chapters 4 to 14. Gomer, unfaithful Gomer, is an illustration of unfaithful Israel. Faithful Hosea depicts the faithful Lord. So the marriage of Hosea actually is a picture of the message of God to Hosea for the whole nation. And so, as Huddleston has it in the Acrostic Bible, Gomer the harlot, that's a good summary. She really is the focus. I love the artist's picture of this one because, you know, why is she going off with this jerk? I mean, he just doesn't look like nearly as good of a husband as Hosea would be, right? But that's the whole point. If you leave your covenant relationship, you go off with someone who's willing to interrupt or destroy your marriage. Nobody ever leaves their spouse for someone else who is wonderful and faithful. Do you catch what I'm saying? And we find this happening all the time. We had illustrations around us all the time of infidelity. How many illustrations around do we find of fidelity? Of husbands who continue to be faithful to that erring wife, or wives who continue to be faithful to that erring husband. The basic idea here is be loyal. And it's a double meaning here. It means be loyal, certainly in the covenant relationship you have in your marriage, if you're married. But in the bigger sense, be loyal to the Lord as he is loyal to us. So the question we need to ask is, How are we doing on our loyalty level? Are you loyal? Are you considered to be a loyal person? Are you considered to be a person that people can count on? I have one friend who's well-meaning, but I'll be honest with you, I do not count on him. When I meet with him, I bring stuff to do because I'm expecting he's going to be late. He's always late. Always. So always bring something when you're going to meet with this guy. He's got all kinds of marriage problems. And, of course, his wife is to blame. So he thinks. But he doesn't show initiative. He doesn't show the kind of care and love for his wife, and she's not very responsive to him. You know? Like I would suspect most women would be. If they don't really sense that their husband is right there being loyal to them. And but are you the kind of person people can count on? If you're late, do you have a great excuse? Or do you have I got up too late, and then, yeah, I missed the bus, but then I could blame the bus, or I could blame something else. You know what I mean? I found that when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I was 16 years old, and I was driving myself to church. You know what I found? I found that I was so consistent that I was consistently 5 minutes late to church. I was always. And one day it dawned on me, wow, I have such a consistency in my life. I'm consistently late. They can count on me to come in 5 minutes after the hour. And I would blame, oh, you know, I had a bunch of red lights along the way, you know, no green lights this time. But I knew the truth of it. The truth of it was I stayed at home right until, it was a 20-minute drive, right until it was exactly 20 minutes. And then I'd jump in my car and I'd be rushing through, and I'd be trying to rush through the light and all that kind of stuff. And one day it dawned on me, you know what? By God's grace, I could change this. I could be able to be counted on. I could leave what's called early. I could have what's called buffer time. And I decided, I'm going to do that because I want to change my reputation. I want to be known as someone that people can count on. My pastor can count on me. My friends can count on me. And that was many years ago. I found that the secret to being on time is to be early. That was brilliant, isn't that? Let me tell you the secret of life. The secret of punctuality is being early. Some of you struggle with that. Some of you struggle with it because for varying reasons. Yeah, Winnie? The secret to loyalty. Oh, you just have a way of asking questions that no one's ever asked before. It causes me to have to really think through that. That's a really great question. Can you guys help me out? You know, the simple answer, of course, is that the Lord helps us to be loyal. And when you really get to know the Lord and you see His faithfulness to you, it just makes you really want to be faithful to Him and faithful to others. I could not be faithful and responsible as a person apart from God having that faithfulness, showing that faithfulness to me. By the way, I'm not the greatest example of loyalty. Even as I'm talking about being punctual, I think about even just last night waiting right in my office right until 6:30, and then walking up to the apartment. I'm always like 2 minutes late, you know. And I'm thinking, can my wife count on me to be 2 minutes late for dinner? You know, maybe she can. Maybe when I'm pointing the finger somewhere else, the three fingers are pointing back at me. You know, we all have areas to grow in this, but I think it starts with a desire. If you don't desire it, if you don't desire to be loyal, you're not going to be loyal. But you know what I found a wonderful thing in my life is that at times that I haven't really desired to follow the Lord in some area and the Lord's convicted me about it, I have asked that God would give me His desire. God would give me the desire to do His will. Philippians 2:13 is a great verse to memorize. It says, "For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for His good purpose," or His good pleasure. Did you get that? "For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure." And I found in my own life, Lord, I don't really want to do this. Lord, would you give me the desire to do it? Would you give me the will to do it? If it's what God wants me to do, if I'm talking about an area of obedience, I found the Lord to be faithful. He's very interested in me being loyal. So when I say, "Lord, I want you to help me be loyal, responsible as a professor, as a pastor, as a husband, as a father, in the various dimensions of my life," I think God's saying, "Oh, Rick, I've been waiting for you to just ask me." Yes, of course I'll help you. So it starts with desire, and it starts with recognizing our need and just asking God to help us with this particular area. And if a particular area comes in your life, I would just encourage you, ask the Lord about it. You will probably be surprised that an area of your life that you consider a weakness and is a genuine weakness can actually be turned into a strength. It's a wonderful thing. Actually, this book talks about how God motivates us to be loyal to Him. And so maybe I can answer the question by showing that Hosea gives two ways that God motivates us to be loyal to Him. God, again, is the subject of this book as He is of all the other books. And so what is God doing in the first three chapters? God motivates loyalty by examples. People need examples of loyalty. You do. I do. I need models of people who are faithful. I got one of them just a few minutes ago during the break. I got on my LinkedIn, one of my friends, it says he has been with his ministry, with Young Life, youth ministry, 46 years. 46 years. So I sent him a little text. I said, "Congratulations on your 46-year work or ministry anniversary." Can you imagine? 46 years with one ministry? That makes my 27 years at SBC look like, oh man, what am I doing? And I'm just getting started, you know? You want to even more so, go down to, if you have not been to the display about Dr. Polson down below, so I'm going to be there for a few more weeks until October 13th. Read through that. Put yourself in his position. He came to Singapore to serve for a few months before going to Indonesia, waiting for his visa back in 1953. 64 years later, still here, serving the Lord faithfully all the way up until two nights before he passed away. I need examples like Dr. Polson, who founded this school here. And I told him many times, one of my life goals is to beat you, Dr. P. You know, I told you this before. So if God wills, then he was here 36 years. If God wills, maybe I could be here 37 years. I need examples like that of people who have gone before me that are faithful. So I can just stop all my excuses why I can't be faithful. You know, you do as well. So I encourage you to encourage those who have gone before you and been models of faithfulness to you to do that. I don't know what kind of support structure Hosea had in his life. I would have guessed that he would have needed some other, especially men, in his life to say, hey, we're going to walk through this with you. What a tragic thing. Especially when he went into the marriage knowing that Gomer was going to be unfaithful. I've never conducted a wedding where the bride and the groom said, oh yeah, we're going to, you know, we're expecting this thing to end with infidelity. You know, I traveled to India a few months ago to do a wedding for two of my people in my church, both from India. I'm not going to travel to India if they don't have any real commitment to make this marriage work. That's why they were willing to go through a lot of premarital counseling before we did that. And we need examples of loyalty, don't you think? Maybe more than ever before. Any of your thoughts? So that's what we have. And that's what God says of Hosea in the first chapter. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord told him, go take to yourself an adulterous wife. What? I can imagine. That's like saying to Abraham, take your son, your only son, the one you love, and go sacrifice him up on Mount Moriah. Sometimes what God says to us just does not make sense at all. But he says, take yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord. And so he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. He's a great example of how he actually responds. I love this picture because Hosea is given money to this another jerk. And the guy, he loves the money, he cares nothing about people. And that's often the way it is in life. And then, yeah. Charmaine, what's your thought?
I'm just thinking as a mom and as a parent, I think most of us would be, is that I was told that, oh, okay, if you come from a complete family that's whole and all that, then you're more likely to also be in such a marriage.
Okay. Yeah, so we do replicate our parents.
Yeah, so I guess marriage is something that's so important, and God uses it to really show by example to people how it should be done between him and...
Yeah. And how old are your children?
My girl is six.
Six.
My boy is 19 months.
Oh, 6 and 19 months. Oh,
so
that's
cute.
Yeah. Life is easy when they're that young.
It's so
yeah. And they're looking to you as a mom, as an example of loyalty. What kind of loyalty do you show to your husband, you know? And what kind of loyalty he shows to you. But is your question, can we overcome our parents' bad examples? The answer, of course, you know, is yes. God's shown that grace in my life. When my dad passed away a few months ago, I took his wife, my stepmom, I took her in my arms to give her a hug. And my dad had just passed away just a few minutes before. And she said to me, who am I going to argue with now? I thought, that's what you think? And I said, argue with me. I'm right here. You can argue with me. But I thought, oh, what a sad thing for her to say. But she was just depicting just how much they argued, you know? And that's what they did. They argued all the time. You don't have to replicate that. You don't have to follow what your parents do, you know? God's grace is so, so extensive. So I don't argue with my wife. I mean, we haven't found anything worth arguing about. We certainly talk about things, and we don't always have the same perspective on things. But what does arguing mean? Arguing means I've got my mind set, and I'm going to defend my way. God can help us to have a selflessness in our relationships where our way is not the most important way. Maybe we could actually be more concerned about our spouse than we can be about ourselves. Novel idea, huh? Philippians 2, 3 to 4. You know, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Wow. We can't do that in our own. God can do that through us. He can help us break those kinds of patterns that we've seen. Bad examples. We're actually talking about a good example here in the first three chapters. The good example, of course, is Hosea depicting what the people of God should be like, rather than being unfaithful to their faithful Lord, to be faithful to Him. But God, to answer this question, how does God motivate us to be loyal to Him? He not only does it through examples, but God motivates loyalty by balancing correction and blessings. And we know, all of us know, as children of our parents, and as many of us being parents ourselves, you have to have some balance there. You can't just constantly correct your kids without any sense of blessing and affirmation. And you can't just affirm them and bless them all the time without ever correcting them. We understand from a human level how important it is to balance these. Well, God certainly does. And if we will recognize that even when God disciplines us, He's demonstrating His loyal love for us, then we won't be so angry at Him. We'll be willing to recognize that's an indication of His hand in our lives. And what did they need to be corrected about? Chapter 4, verse 1 is a key verse in the book. As we go from the marriage tragedy of Hosea now to the second half of the book, this is a good hinge verse of the book. Hear the word of the Lord, O people of Israel. The Lord has brought charges against you, saying, there's no faithfulness, no kindness, and no knowledge of God in your land. There's the charge. This is courtroom language here. This is legal language. When the court opens, when it comes into session, you have to hear a charge, right? What is the charge? The person has to make the accusation, and then there is a response to it. He says here, there's no knowledge of God. He puts that third, but actually chapters 4 to 6 address that whole issue. Israel doesn't really know their Lord. There's no real knowledge of Him. So chapters 4 to 6, 3 address that. And then there's no kindness. Or there's no, here's chesed again, loving loyalty. This word used to be thought to mean just loving kindness, but a very instrumental study by Nelson Gluck in 1927 that you have there on your notes pointed out that this is actually talking about covenant loyalty. So you could translate this as there's no covenant loyalty in the land. And this occupies our chapter 6, 4 to 11, 11. So the bulk of the book is talking about this loving loyalty. That study that I'm talking about is on page 567, where it used to be thought that this word, chesed, it used to be translated love. Now we understand it's actually talking about, it's not just a gushy love, it's a commitment to a promise made, a covenant promise. It's a covenant term. And it's appropriate that the word Lord is used here, not God. Because the word Yahweh, the word Lord, is the covenant word, our title for God. God is the covenant God who makes His promises. So the Lord's chesed means He's a covenant-keeping God who says He's going to be loyal. Whereas if you say Elohim or God, God's greatness, it gives a whole nother aspect of God. It's talking about his power. This is not so much talking about his power, but his commitment. And he's saying, the Lord's committed to you, but you're not committed to him. And then the third charge, the first actually, that is addressed third, is there's no faithfulness. And so chapters 11 to 13 address this idea that the people have not been faithful to the Lord. So this begins the last verse of chapter 11. Ephraim has surrounded me with lies, the house of Israel with deceit, and Judah is unruly against God, even against the faithful Holy One. One of the signs of being faithful is you don't tell lies. Right? I mean, a marriage that's built on lies is not going to last. There has to be a sense of trust and truth in any relationship. And he's saying, you guys are telling lies about me. You're obviously not faithful. And so here's the basic idea, I think, of the book of Hosea. God's loyal to you, so be loyal to him. It's quite simple. He's loyal. He keeps his promises. How about you? You keep your promises? How are you doing at being loyal to your loyal Lord? One of the great examples of that we find in the New Testament is the woman who was just so broken over her sin that she didn't want to look at Jesus. She cried over his feet and dried those tears with her hair. And Jesus commended her loyalty. And that's what God is certainly expecting of us in terms of having that same loyalty to him that he has for us. Okay, let me just close with turning your attention to page 592, and I'll sum up the last three books that we've studied: Jonah, Amos, and Hosea. What we have here, I call it the perils of prosperity. You say, prosperity? What's wrong with prosperity? Well, we love prosperity. Well, there are certain perils that go along with it. And Jonah points out that there is a myopia that often comes with prosperity. You know, myopia, nearsightedness. We can't see very far because, wow, we've got so many distractions. When you think of myopia, think of people having an entire world available to them, but they're just looking at their phone. I find it so humorous to walk through the Singapore Botanic Gardens, which in my opinion is the most beautiful part of Singapore. I mean, it's a feast for the eyes, and people are looking at their phones while they're walking through the garden. You know what I mean? Put the silly phone down and look at God's creation. That's what Israel was doing. It was like they're looking at their phones and they're not seeing the needs of the nations. And so Jonah is raised up by God to demonstrate God's compassion. Our key word was compassion. God's key attribute is compassion. I summed up Jonah: God cares even for you cruel Gentiles, so you should too. God cares even for cruel Gentiles. If God cares for people that are just absolutely wicked and turning their hearts away from him, shouldn't we? Our modern perils would be our failure and our mission responsibility. To me, it's a sad thing to think that the church took about 18 centuries before we actually started bringing the gospel out beyond Europe. You know, that the church reached Europe pretty much in the first century. But how long did it take to go from Europe to other parts of the world? To go to Africa, to go to Asia, to go to the New World. I guess they brought it to the New World by that time. But so this is really at the beginning of Jeroboam's reign. That's why we covered Jonah first. And then we talked about Amos. And the responsibility addressed is not evangelistic, but it's social. Their problem, in addition to myopia of seeing God's heart for the nations, was seeing God's heart for their own people with justice in their own community. And so Amos was the fiery preacher who said things like, a father is teaching his son to use the same girl. They sleep with the same girl on the same day. That's that kind of, in Amos 3, that kind of language is so depicting God's desire for justice. And so our key word is injustice for Amos. God's fair with you, so you should be fair with others, is a good summary, I think, for the book. And in our context, we see the oppression of maids and foreign workers in the Singapore context. You could probably tell me stories. I could certainly tell you plenty of stories. Friends working from Myanmar, working on the MRT in the mud up to their waist and getting paid $18 a day. 18 Singapore dollars a day. That's like 12 US dollars a day. To work in the mud. And not treated fairly, not only in the financial area, but if they're sick, then their pay is docked. The $18 is docked from their pay to miss a day of work. So we see these workers under the ground here in Singapore. We don't see them, actually. But they're just sick as a dog, but they can't afford the $18. Can't afford to have their pay docked because there's no incentive for them to actually stay back and heal up. You know what I mean? It's a sad thing. I work with lawyers and... this particular man I'm talking about, he ended up getting purchased out of it by some friends who bought him out of his slavery here, where he had a one-year contract, and after 7 months, he still had not paid back the agent. He still had not made any money after 7 months, and he was certainly not on track to have any money to bring with him after a year. And so... $1,800 later, from two friends, he was bought out of his modern slavery. When I see that kind of thing going on under our nose, that's not God's plan. That's not God's desire. But it certainly helps us to rally around people that we see are being treated unjustly. And I know every one of us here has experienced injustice, and we've seen others experience injustice. Amos tells us, don't let it happen on your watch. Don't let it happen where you have some authority, where you can do something about something. And if the Lord brings a certain thing to mind for you, where you can have some say, and then do it. That's all I would say. And then in Hosea, we see the spiritual adultery problem that also comes from prosperity. Hosea says, you guys have so much money, and what are you using your money for? Thinking of chapter 10. Hosea 10, 1. Israel was a spreading vine, and he brought forth fruit for himself. As his fruit increased, he built more altars. As his land prospered, he adorned his sacred stones. You get it? God gave the people money, more money than they needed. And so what did they do with the money? They went and spent the money on idolatry. And do we not see the same thing happen in our days? Here's my question for you. As the Lord prospers you, as he gives you more money, does the percentage of your giving go up or does it go down? You know, I think every one of us here is fed well enough. Did you have a breakfast today? I think we all had breakfast. I did. I had enough money for breakfast. Here's one of my goals in life, all right? As the Lord gives me more money, my goal is for my percentage of my income to go up rather than go down. Studies in my country, in the United States, shows that the person of average income gives about 3% of their income away. That's pretty sad. And that's for a fairly generous nation. Americans are known generally to be fairly generous. But as their income doubles, the percentage of the income they give away goes down to like 2%. And if they're really, really wealthy, it's about 1%. Why? Because they're looking at the actual money. Well, 1% of $1 billion, that's a lot of money. You know, where it was easy, Nelson Rockefeller said, it was easy to tithe when I was only making $20 a week. But pretty soon he was making $20,000 a day. And it was the early 1900s. And he said, that makes it more difficult to tithe. So his pastor said, okay, I will pray that God will bring you back to $20 a week. That way you can tithe again, you know. No thanks. But God is loyal to you, so be loyal to him. And sometimes our God is not God. Our God is modernity. Our God is methods. Our God is materialism and all these things that you know about, right? So there's a quick summary of these three prophets that God raised up during a time of great prosperity. Jonah, Amos, Hosea. They didn't all do the same thing. Only Jonah went to Nineveh. You know, only Hosea married a harlot. God had a different plan for each one of their lives, but they fit in and they did what God wanted them to do. And this is my prayer for you and for me, that we would be people who do not experience the perils of prosperity, but instead of prosperity being perilous for us, prosperity would be an opportunity for us to be a blessing to those that don't have the blessings that we have.